Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. It has been, incredibly, 2 years since we have started the On Air podcast. And as is our tradition that so far has only happened once, on our anniversary birthday, we like to do our end of year awards. So we are going to, as we did last year, look over the past 12 months, November to November, which is, you know, really inconvenient time, and award royals with certain accolades and award some moments with being very special moments in this year.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so if you want to go and listen to last year's award ceremony, that is episode 46, a very dramatic year. But yeah, shall we kick off?
Let's just jump in.
Let's go for it. Okay, so our first category is the class clown. Last year we went with Prince Louis, I think. This year I think I've gone for the royal who is physically probably the opposite of Prince Louis, but spiritually I would say is like a kindred spirit to Prince Louis, which is, well, my choice is King Carl Gustaf of Sweden.
As soon as she started that sentence, I knew what you were going to say.
Yeah. Okay, who is your choice? What did you go for?
Yeah, I found this really hard. This is the one I found the hardest. But I went for the role that I think has actually made me laugh the most this year, who is Prince William.
See, this is what happened last time, where you gave Prince William your Royal of the Year, and it just, I don't think even you were expecting that.
I genuinely had not decided, and he wasn't on my list of options, and his name just came out of my mouth. And it was a genuine shock to everyone involved. But I did think about this one, and he is the one I've settled on.
So, my choice was King Carl Gustaf of Sweden. I've always thought that Carl Gustaf was hilarious. I've always found him incredibly funny. But this year was his Jubilee, which we covered in episode 75. And there was a documentary about him that was produced as part of this Jubilee, which I watched, which is a very good documentary if you can find it. That documentary had its own very funny moments throughout it, which there are moments where, like, if I describe them, they don't sound particularly funny, but they are very funny, let me assure you. So for example, like, he was in the middle of being interviewed by somebody, and then he just sort of went like, oh my goodness, I booked lunch with people, I'm supposed to be in a room somewhere over there, you know, and like he freaked out and he just ran out of the room without telling anybody, like, oh, I should probably go and see these people who I've abandoned, who I was supposed to be meeting for lunch. He just ran out of the room and left all of these interview people and camera people standing there like, what's happened? And there were lots of funny moments where, you know, he's quite dry, he's quite blunt. And, you know, if the interviewer was sort of asking him questions about, like, you know, has this been a good experience and have you enjoyed being interviewed? And he was always just like, no, I haven't. No, I don't think we're going to be friends anytime soon. You know, he's very blunt. But I also think because of that documentary, it kind of gave me the opportunity to reflect on a lot of his previous funny moments that we discussed in that episode. So, I mean, his terrible but very enthusiastic dancing. He's the dancing king. ABBA wrote that song really about him and then just had to change the details so they didn't get sued. There was the press conference, which we mentioned in episode 5, where he was rumoured to have gone to sex clubs, and somebody asked him at the press conference, do you go to sex clubs? And he was like, well, what define a sex club? Which is the funniest thing that's ever happened. When he interrupted a very serious interview to ask the cameraman to film a cat that was nearby that he'd seen. you know, moments like that. And so I kind of feel like for this category, what I've done, it's like, you know, when in the Oscars, they have somebody who's been nominated like 5 times and then they win the Oscar on their 6th nomination or something. And it's not necessarily their best performance or even necessarily the best performance of the year, but they've got it because of like the cumulative impact of their career and the fact that people think, oh, well, they probably should have got it earlier. King Carl Gustaf, I think he was funny this year, but he got this award from me based on his cumulative contribution to royal comedy.
That's a great thing to be known for contributing to.
Exactly, I think so, yes. I think his sense of humour is not something that everybody would necessarily like, but I just, he's kind of like a grumpy old man who is a bit awkward and very blunt. I don't know. He tickles me.
Yeah, I see that. It makes a lot of sense. And he definitely, I think, has had the biggest cumulative impact on real comedy. So.
Yes. So yes, go for William.
Well, my problem was I couldn't think of any role that had been particularly funny this year. Mm-hmm. So that really sort of limited my options straight away to no one. So then I started thinking about the times. Well, first of all, I searched on as many royal blogs as I could for the word funny or laugh or humour.
Okay.
And to see what came up, to see if any like anything sparked my interest. And there wasn't much, to be fair. But occasionally there would be William, and I noticed it was the same type of sort of humour every time. And it's the type of humour that I always notice with him, which is this really kind of dry, self-deprecating British humour.
British, yeah.
Where he's very much, you know, there was one the other week where they were talking about hair and he was like, oh, no, I don't have very good hair. You probably shouldn't ask me that question.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I remembered him going when he was doing his Homewards launch and went into some sort of children's book reading and he was doing like a slow motion walk in the background. And it's very silly, like it's dad humor, it's pure like capital dad humor, but he does always make me laugh. It always gets me right at the right moment. I'm like, that's quite funny. And I think he's definitely very good at making jokes at his own expense, but not in a way that you're like, oh, this rich man's making jokes about, you know, his poor life. They're jokes about, you know, the fact that he's bold, or you know, that him and his wife battle over who's better at sport and things like that. Yeah, and I think a bit like you, I was thinking he probably is the royal over the years who's made me laugh the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not sure he's had a standout moment of hilarity this year, but there have been lots of small moments that have made me laugh. If I was going to describe William, I probably would put funny as a description of him. So it made sense to pick for Prince William this year.
Yeah, I think you're right. He is actually a funny person. You know, he'd make you laugh. He'd be a good person to go on a night out with or something. Like he'd be a laugh. I do think also this year he's sort of captured the market of being the funniest guy to the elderly women of the United Kingdom.
He really has. Old women absolutely love him. Like whenever he sees an old woman, they're like, "My William," and they just cling on to him, pincer grips.
Yeah,
and they're like, "You're the funniest man I've ever met. You're amazing. I love you. Don't care about my husband anymore. Bye, Reginald. I love you."
Bye, Reginald. Yeah, no, I think there's been a few moments throughout this past year where, like, quite recently actually, he was in a group of women, a group of sort of older women. And they were all posing for a photograph and he said something about like, who's that trying to pinch my bottom? And they all were in hysterics. They loved it. So yeah, I think it has been a good year for William's sense of humour. He hasn't upset anyone, but he's been funny.
Yeah, I think he errs on that line of like, it's funny and it will make anyone laugh. From like, it's a dad joke that a child would laugh at, but also your grandma might laugh at it. But it's not dipped into being those kind of like to the point where you're like, okay, stop that joke now, that's boring.
Definitely, yeah, good choices. Our next category is, I believe, best dressed, and I think, well, we know we have the same person, I think, unless you've changed your mind over the last couple
of weeks.
No,
I'm fairly sure we have the same person.
Yeah, so a few weeks ago there was, when we had Christian's birthday episode, we were talking about our favorite looks from that, and there was a moment where Grace said Princess Elizabeth of Belgium. And I said, oh, well, she was one of my favourites as well, but I didn't mention her in my notes because I know that I'm going to mention her in an episode in the future. And then Grace went, so am I. And so I think that at that moment, we realised we probably have the same person for this category. So do we have the same person?
We do have the same person.
Okay, so we have Princess Elizabeth, who is the heir to the throne of Belgium.
I think, for me, Princess Elizabeth of Belgium has always had a great sense of style since she kind of hit 18 and became a grown-up royal, but she hit this spot for me, number one spot, at Rajwa and Hussein's wedding, and has not left it since. So she has been flying high since the summer in a top dress spot for me all year round.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting time at the moment. Actually, funnily enough, I did a a part of this edit series on Instagram a while ago. I'm doing a second part in the next few weeks, which is kind of looking at the next generation of royal style icons or fashionistas, I should say. And there's quite a lot of them at the moment. And so we're starting to see them in public as adults. You know, obviously they've been picking their own clothes for a while, I'm sure, but like they're developing more of a sense of style. And I think Elizabeth has been a really promising candidate, as you say, since she turned 18 a few years ago. And she often goes under the radar. I don't think she necessarily gets enough credit for some of the really great outfits that she's worn. So over the last year, there was a Christmas concert last year, which she did this like slinky electric blue, not sort of gown sort of thing. They went to Egypt and she had this like trouser suit thing, but the top was like a cape. She had, as you say, the pink cape gown at Rajwan Hussein's wedding, and then the blue sort of sparkly gown that she wore in the evening. And then the look that we talked about at Christian's birthday, where it's kind of like the gown with the opera gloves, really long opera gloves. I think what I'm seeing is that she has this really classic, beautifully tailored kind of sense of style, but it doesn't feel stuffy. It doesn't feel old fashioned or too mature. It's kind of like she's found this way of making something that looks elegant, but also still youthful.
And I think she takes quite a few risks, but they don't always, people don't note them as risks. Like she wore like a silvery, bluey, grey dress with silvery, bluey, grey opera gloves. And that's a hard look to pull off, but no one's going, wow, what a risky look from Princess Elizabeth of Belgium.
Yeah.
And I think because she pulls them off so well, people don't think about them as being a bit out there, because you're just like, oh, she looks amazing, that must be such a nice normal outfit. If you imagine it on, you know, anyone else, you're like, actually that's a really impressive look to pull off. And I think, you know, she's also one of the few young royals that we've seen quite a bit in both military evening clothes and in like normal day-to-day outfits, and she's very even in both. Like some royals are phenomenal in evening wear, but their day-to-day choices are a bit iffy, or it kind of goes the other way. But I think, you know, her, when she was in Egypt at the start of the year, I did describe her entire wardrobe as like Howard Carter-esque.
Yes,
like,
it was.
And it just looked good, and it suited her, and it suited the situation.
When I'm looking at like style, somebody who's stylish rather than somebody who's like, or sort of the best dressed, or you know, what, rather than somebody who's kind of just wears nice clothes, I think it's not about whether or not I actually like a dress. It's not about whether or not a dress is, you know, quote unquote pretty or anything like that. It doesn't matter if you're following trends or not. What I want to see is somebody who has like a really clear sense of themselves and who wears things with confidence. I think it's because I want the things that, or to me, the most stylish thing is the opposite of what I have, or is like, it's somebody who's achieved the thing that I can't achieve, which is feeling like confident going out in their clothes and knowing that they, you know, and somebody who can like put together an outfit rather than just sort of wearing clothes. So it's all those things that I don't necessarily think I have in myself. I just wear clothes and I don't really know what looks good on me or what doesn't, and I don't feel confident in the things that I wear. So those are the things that I'm looking for, whether the dress is pretty or not. If you wear it with confidence, if you style it, if you are making a deliberate choice to, you know, wear something, if you look confident in it, like those are the things that really matter to me. And I think that usually takes quite a long time to develop, but it's fascinating seeing Elizabeth as somebody who is so young, but yet clearly has a really clear aesthetic, a really clear eye. She knows what works on her. Like her tailoring is incredible. Her accessorizing is really gorgeous. You know, she feels like she just popped up one day as like a full package of knowing exactly what looks good on her, knowing what makes her feel comfortable, knowing how to style an outfit. But I think she's one of the few people who's going to be able to, when she's like 40 or 50, look back and not have had an awkward phase.
Yeah, she'll just be like, yeah, I've always looked good my whole life.
Yeah, I can't swear on the podcast. It really has been her year. Like, I don't think she gets enough praise. Not that I think our podcast is necessarily going to change that, but you never know.
But when there's an article next week on best dressed young royal, I'm going to take full credit.
Absolutely. Yes, as we should.
For our third category, we are heading to the most improved royal, which is obviously the royal that has
improved the most.
Improved the most, because they had the biggest like work glow up in the last year. Mm-hmm. I feel like it sounds mean, and I don't mean it in a mean way at all, because my chosen royal is Princess Leonor of Spain.
Ooh, okay. Well, I went with a collective answer. I could pick one individual if I had to, but I went with the collective answer of the Dutch royal family.
Ooh, was not expecting that.
Yeah, I could pick King Willem Alexander if I absolutely had to, but I don't. I would go with the collective of the Dutch royal family. Okay, well, I have no idea why you picked Leonor, so let's go with Leonor.
Okay, so my argument was that Leonor has, until very recently, been in full-time education, and we've seen her a couple of times a year. We've seen her, like, in the summer with her family, maybe once at Christmas, once at Easter, and at the Princess of Asturias Awards. And she's always been great, but it really has been in the last few months we have seen her go into the military. We've seen her do the military parades. We've seen her do more royal things. Her birthday, which was only 2 episodes ago, but everything that went with that, the speeches she's given. I think that within a few months, she went from being a child royal who, you know, makes the occasional appearance and gives speeches to, you know, being pretty much a working royal already and doing the speeches. She is going to be in the military for the next 3 years. But even though she's in the military, she hasn't not been doing her royal job alongside it. And I think that we probably aren't going to see her quite as much for the next few years because she's in the military. But she has done so much. And the difference from, you know, 16 to 17-year-old Leonor and 17 to 18-year-old Leonor is huge. And I just think she is one to watch for the future.
I definitely would agree with that. I think I've always thought that Leonor was a very sort of poised, composed young woman, credit to her family. But I think this past year, even just these past few months, you know, there's been a huge amount of pressure on Leonor's shoulders, because Spain is a country that has quite a lot of upheaval and political changes and all sorts of things going on. And also the Spanish royal family have had a really difficult time. And so there's a lot of pressure on Leonor's shoulders to show that at young age, she's kind of dependable and she is sensible and she's the future of the monarchy, which is a lot to place on the shoulder of somebody who only just turned 18 in October, at the end of October, the last day. You know, it's not long ago. And yet she's always seemed to have risen to the challenge. Her speech was really great. She came across as very intelligent, so the content was good, not just the delivery.
Yeah, I think she's always really impressed me. Since the moment she turned 13, she's impressed me. I am fascinated with your opinion on the Dutch royals. I did not see this one coming at all.
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that this isn't the best royal family category or the best royal category. This is the most improved. So if you did terribly and you did not do terribly this year, I consider that to be the most improved. So if we think about this time last year, the Dutch royals were still kind of overshadowed by what they'd done during COVID. So they'd been on holiday when they weren't supposed to be on holiday. And they'd had a big party, which had been a little bit controversial because, you know, people were supposed to be staying at home. And so people were really angry at them. And, you know, they had to go on television and do a public apology to everybody, which is massive. You don't see royals doing that very often. There was also sort of external things going on that were quite difficult for them that they had no control over, like the threat against Caterina Amalia. So we talked about that in a previous episode, but there was a threat from a organized crime group against Amalia. They were going to kidnap her. So last year, both because of their own choices and because of things that were going on around them, it was a difficult time for them. But I think actually over the last year, they've barely featured on this podcast one way or another, because they really have not done anything that I can remember that was massively controversial compared to what they've been going through the year before. There were some real highlights for them. So like they kicked off the year with a really successful tour of the Caribbean part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. There were obviously protesters and things, but compared to other recent high profile visits to the Caribbean, like it went incredibly well. And it also gave the opportunity for Amalia, who's the heir to the throne, to go on her first big overseas tour, and she didn't put a foot wrong. You had William Alexander apologising for the Netherlands' role in the slave trade, which was a huge milestone for royals. And obviously, again, this is not just his decision, but he got a lot of the positive attention for it. So that's episode 68, if you want to go back and listen to that. There was a crisis with the government in the Netherlands. I don't really know too much about it, but there was. And William Alexander was on holiday at the time, but he came back immediately, which I think showed that they had learned from the COVID situation of like, if there's something going on, you have to prioritize that over your holiday. And then they also had like two really positive things that happened throughout the year that kind of generated a lot of, good coverage for them. So they had the 10th anniversary of William Alexander's accession to the throne, and then also their daughter Alexia turned 18, and she was able to, she went to her first sort of solo engagement where she christened a boat. You know, over the course of the year, I'm not saying they weren't necessarily the greatest royal family or that they did everything perfectly or that, you know, anything like that, but I think in terms of when you compare them to where we were last year, when there were like think pieces being written about whether or not the Dutch monarchy would even survive, to where they are now, which is like, they haven't done anything massively wrong. We've only talked about them once over the last year, I think. They've had a lot of improvements in the way that they conduct themselves, but also in those sorts of things that happen that they've had no control over. So like, we've been able to see Amalia a lot more, and she's obviously been safe and okay. And, you know, so I think the Dutch royals are in a much better place than they were, you know, this time last year, which to me qualifies them for the most improved.
I see that, definitely. I quite like how it started with the really backhanded compliment of like, yeah, these were the worst, and now they are not the worst.
Yeah, that's basically it.
But I understand, and I think, you know, I'd forgotten like about the slavery comments which were really sort of significant. And I'd forgotten how big sort of their sort of King's Day was this year, their national day. Obviously, clearly the start of the year just blurred together in my mind. I definitely understand and see that a lot of that makes a lot of sense. And I think they have improved a lot. And, you know, like you said, they seem to have learned from the bad mistakes they made in the last few years. So our next category is for the most athletic royal. And I found this really, really, really hard, and actually a different person down 2 days ago and changed my answer at the last minute. But I have settled on the Princess of Wales.
Me too. I did not find this hard at all. I was like, yep. It was so the way I did this was I had like all the categories on my phone, and then throughout the year I was adding things, or throughout the last few months anyway, I've been adding things as they come to me. And Kate was the only one where I think I wrote her down maybe sort of autumn time, early autumn, late summer, and she's the only, I think, the only category where I've just been like, yep, that's it, no one else.
Well, I originally had Prince Christian of Denmark.
Okay.
And then I was thinking, trying to think of what he's actually done this year that's been athletic and isn't just my impression of him as being a very sporty person. And like, I've occasionally seen him at F1 things, and I was like, I don't actually think that qualifies him for this role. I think in the future this could be his category going forward, but at present he probably hasn't actually done anything, whereas Kate's done a lot, so it made a lot of sense to go for Kate.
Yeah. And last year we picked Frederick, so the Danes and the Brits seem to be fighting this out between the two of them.
Yeah, so it's pretty much a two-horse race for the athleticism category.
Yeah. Well, I guess I could say two words as to why I chose Kate. I will obviously say more than that, but I could... I'll start with the two. Tennis and rugby.
That's what I wrote down.
Yeah. Great. That's amazing. We're on the same page. We need to disagree with each other more, Grace.
I know. Next time we'll just pick something completely different. I'm like, my first athletic royal is Prince Albert of Monaco. Prove me wrong.
I mean, he was an Olympian. I'll go with Queen Margrethe. Anyway, so I think tennis, I mean, she always goes to Wimbledon, so it's not a massive surprise. But for me, it was the video.
Yes. Tennis with Roger.
Yes. Tennis with Roger. Yes, she did a video with where she sort of went to in the inner workings of the Wimbledon tournament, and she met with some of the ball boys and the ball girls, who are the people who pick up the balls when they're flying about all the place. And she played some tennis with Roger Federer. And I mean, I like that anyway, because I think Wimbledon could be a patronage where it's just her going to watch something that she enjoys and we don't really get any benefit out of it whatsoever and she doesn't actually do anything. But I think I picked it because it gave the opportunity for her to show her own athleticism.
I mean, I'm sure that was not Roger Federer playing at Roger Federer level, but he was not, you know, going, he was playing tennis mm-hmm. and she was holding her own. So.
Yeah. I mean, Roger, I know Roger Federer is a friend of hers and might, and probably doesn't want to say, oh yeah, she's absolutely awful. But he, you know, he's always said that she's very good. And I you know, I think it would be pretty arrogant of me to be like, actually, Roger Federer, I think I know more about tennis than you do. Roger Federer, guys. So yeah, I think like, you know, she held her own against Roger. It was great. And then also she did a lot of like the trials that the ball girls and I can't say that ball boys and boy girl ball boys and ball girls. It's a really hard thing for me to say for some reason. But she joined them for their training. And there's a lot of like, they do these weird, if you don't watch tennis, they do these weird sort of arm movements where they have to like hold the ball really high up in the air. And it's a lot about like, they have to have really strong reflexes so they don't get hit in the face at 100 miles an hour. But they also have to have like this precision in their movements. And she was picking it up incredibly quickly.
I know. She was just like full on catching balls hit by Roger Federer at yeah. full speed. Just yeah. casually, like naturally. I was like, what on earth? When a child throws a pen at me, I drop it like 9 and I'm like, oh, sorry, guys.
Yes, I would be useless at it. But, you know, these kids are in training for like weeks to be able to do this. And Kate was just like, oh, yeah, this is fine. Yeah. So it was, I think it was a really good video to kind of go above and beyond just watching a sport of like she was actually participating. She was actually good at it. And she, I think she showed her sort of natural that just she does have a natural athleticism. Like I really enjoy watching tennis, but I couldn't play it. Whereas she it does a really good job of that. The other area was for me was rugby.
Yeah.
And for me, I think there was a lot of negativity towards the British Royals in particular, but the representation around Royals and how they represent the sports that they're interested in or that they have some sort of connection with, particularly obviously around Prince William and his support or lack thereof, or perceived lack thereof for women's football. And for me, I think over the last year, you know, we saw Kate take on a role, is it England rugby?
Yeah, she did England rugby, union and league.
Yeah, so she's got those patronages. And I think that over the last year, we have seen her like be the exact opposite of all of those negative conversations. She has been a really great example of how as a patron you can support everybody who, you know, inclusivity and accessibility of the sport. And just because you're a patron of rugby doesn't mean that you only ever go and watch the main rugby matches. I think she's done a really excellent job of representing all of the different people who play this sport.
Yeah, I think she's seen the men's teams in national competitions, often, you know, along with other members of the royal family who are patrons of rugby. So, you know, with William or Princess Anne. But then she's gone above and beyond that because she's been to training sessions. She's met with the wheelchair rugby team. She's met with the wheelchair rugby sort of trainees. She's met with female rugby players, children, young people, disabled people, people, you know, who use rugby as a form of like therapy. And she has just done the whole thing. And she does it quite regularly. It's not like she, obviously she loves tennis, but she does tennis in the summer mm-hmm. because tennis is a summer thing and it's fine. And there have been times when she's done like tennis in February, but she doesn't really do tennis the rest of the year. Whereas she's done rugby, you know, starting in February, and she was last time she did something in rugby was in October, you know, so it's been the whole sort of breadth of the year fairly regularly, fairly into sort of spaced, and like you mentioned, she's met with so many people and not just gone to watch two rugby matches.
She's avoided all of the missteps that William has made, and you know, has always seems to be thinking about like everybody who plays this sport rather than just the national team, the men's national team.
Yeah, and I think she takes her work sort of with all sports in general, but particularly rugby, into schools a lot. Like she did something with Kelly Holmes earlier in the year that was for World Mental Health Day, I think. Or no, it wasn't. It was earlier than that. But she did that, and it was obviously that was her choice of the day was to you show, and it was with girls again. It was a girls' school, and it was using sport to sort of promote positive mental well-being, and she was using sort of rugby skills and showing off what she could, sort of showing off her skills, but managing to promote rugby and mental well-being, which you know allows her to sort of always be sort of something she's really passionate about, which is this kind of mental well-being, but not just going to talks and meeting toddlers and being like, wow, we should be happy. You know, it's the way she manages to still promote things like rugby and tennis and running. You know, kind of as much as she can.
Well, I think that's actually my last point as to why I gave this to her, which is something that came out of the rugby podcast that she did, her, William and Anne did with Mike Tyndall and his friends. I think in that episode, she spoke really clearly about sport as a mechanism for something else. So sport's role in kind of inspiring people, sport's role in building positive skills like teamwork and focus and commitment and all those sorts of things. I think through that, I mean, this is obviously a given, but it was really nice to hear her sort of talk about sports in more general terms and to see like how deeply team sports in particular have influenced her character. She can speak really articulately about why sports matter so much to her and why she champions it so much. And so I think that's why I particularly chose her, because not just she's shown her own athleticism, she's also shown a lot of commitment to all of the different people who play sports rather than being quite narrowly focused. I think the third factor is the fact that I genuinely feel like sports and participating in sports influences Kate when she's at an engagement that has nothing to do with sports at all.
Yeah, she very much, I think, champions sport when she's not talking about sport, like just as who she is. And she, I think, you know, like you mentioned the podcast, she gave a really good point about how it's all to do with, you mentioned teamwork and like fairness and how those skills that you use in your everyday life, they're not just sports skills, but that's how they often get treated.
So our next category is the cutest couple.
Romantic choice.
And this was another one where I found it quite difficult and I had different choices at different points throughout the year. But in the end, I have gone with Queen Letizia and King Felipe of Spain.
So have I.
Right. Oh, great.
Need to start disagreeing. Honestly,
We
this
need,
is
I
getting
know. Well, clearly it's a consensus. Like we're obviously right because we both say the same thing and we did not confer in any way. I think there were lots of cute moments of them throughout the year that I could mention. There was a lot of like looking at, I think people say heart eyes, don't they, when they like look up at each other like lovingly, adoringly. There were lots of sweet moments like that. I didn't think that separated them necessarily, but the thing that did was the recreation of their first public appearance together. Is that the same for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in episode four, we discussed how I think it was the Prince of Asturias Awards at the time in 2003. She was there as a journalist because Queen Letizia, before she was a royal, was a very successful journalist. And he was there as the Prince of Asturias because it was his award ceremony. And in the sort of green room bit, they did all of the members of the press who were there did a lineup. And the prince went down and shook their hands. And so Letizia was there in the lineup. He went down, shook hands with her. What people didn't know was that at the time they were secretly dating. And very shortly afterwards, we found out that they had gotten engaged. And so those moments of them greeting each other when nobody knew that they were dating each other, they became like an iconic moment. So people, everybody reading into like the glances between them and like this them trying not to show that they knew each other, but also not trying to make it look like they were making it look like they didn't know each other. And it's a very sweet moment. And then this year, they attended the Princess of Asturias Awards. Their daughter has now taken it over, obviously, as she's the heir to the throne. And it was 20 years since that first meeting. I think this is, I've heard of this is on Letizia's request. she asked if they could like recreate that iconic moment. So she joined the lineup and he went and shook her hand as if she was just a member of the press who was there. And they like recreated the moment that they'd had 20 years ago when he shook her hand in the lineup. And it was the cutest thing.
It was so cute and so like cheesy. It was just, I loved it. It was very sweet. And it's also, you know, like such like a thing that people do normally. Like they do like, oh, remember when we did this? But, and it was so funny and it was so cute. But like royals don't do that. The amount of times we've seen royals at the place where they met their partner, you know, like how many times have Will and Kate been back to the University of St. Andrews and they've never been like, remember when we kissed on this bench?
That'd be a bit weird if they did. I don't know if I like that.
But it was so sweet and just very sort of human. And you could see how happy they were, like how funny they found it to recreate this moment. And, you know, they're so cute all the time. Like I was watching them at Leonor's birthday and they just were, you know, they were just looking at each other every now and then like, we did this. This is our baby. She's all grown up. But it's just such a sweet thing. And every time I look at that picture, it makes me smile. So,
No, I thought it was, you know, there's a reputation that Letizia in particular has of being like, which I think is unfair, but it's the reputation that a lot of people have think of her as having, of kind of being cold and distant and a bit standoffish and all. And I thought it was just really sweet that, you know, it was her idea as well. Like, oh, wouldn't this be funny? It was like a moment where they sort of broke out of being royals and they were just sort of like giddy young people again, recreating this moment between the two of them. There weren't that many like a really cute, adorable moments throughout the course of the year. So that was enough. That moment was cute enough to to win them the whole prize.
Yeah, it was a top moment for them in general. So, and they just looked very happy and very sweet and very giggly.
Very giggly, yes. Yeah, it was very much, I mean, they didn't meet when they were teenagers, but it kind of had that feeling of like, you know, obviously it must have been quite exciting for them when they were sort of hiding there, probably stressful as well, but like there might have been an level of like, oh, you're doing, you know, we're doing something naughty, we're hiding your relationship, ooh, ooh, ooh. It kind of brought back that sort of giddy, youthful vibe, which was really nice to see. Not that I'm talking about them like they're 75, but
these old people being in love.
Yeah, they've forgotten what love is, it's been so long.
So our next category is best bromance for the friends amongst us, and I chose for this category Mike Tyndall and Princess Anne.
I could have chosen that because I went William and Anne.
Ooh, Anne is really just a friend royal here,
which is a shocker really that Anne's being chosen in a category of awarding friendliness. I love Anne, but that's not the first word that would come to mind when I think about her. I was debating, like, literally yesterday, whether or not to put Mike or William. I think I could put the three of them as a collective, to be honest.
Yeah, they were the three in my head. I had Mike and William for a bit, and then Anne and William, but I went Mike and Anne at the end.
Yeah.
It couldn't mean any of them.
Yeah. Okay. You. I'm sure we've got exactly the same reason, because it would be shocking if we didn't have the same reason. But you go ahead first.
I mean, yes, it is predominantly to the Good, the Bad and the Rugby podcast episode, which came out just before the Rugby World Cup started with Mike Tyndall and his crew interviewing Anne and William and Kate. And there were just so many sweet moments in that episode. But I loved things like Anne and Mike sort of been teasing each other about their driving, and Mike teasing Anne about like leaving Peter at sports days and things like that. And it was just such a really sort of natural insight into their relationship. And it did make me think of all those other times that we've had heard Mike talk about Anne, you know, in, like when he was on I'm a Celebrity, which would fall into this year group, so I counted that as well. It was only last year. And he spoke a lot about, you know, like him and Anne, like how he'd play pranks on Anne and they just would never work, and you know how much respect he has for her, And I just thought it always keep, they always have come across as having a lovely relationship. But in this past year, we've seen it so much more open and public with it. And it's really nice to see.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So we talked about this, the podcast, the rugby podcast in episode 74. And I think, I could easily have said Mike and Anne as well. I think it's, you know, flip a coin really as to what I would have decided, because you're right. They like, Anne is a scary lady to me as somebody who doesn't know her. Like, that's not a bad thing. But she's like an intimidating person. And to have Mike there kind of making fun of her, not in a way that was rude, but like, he didn't seem to be scared of her. Like that was, I was just like, gosh, she's, you know, she's his mother-in-law. Mothers-in-law are supposed to be scary anyway. And your mother-in-law is Princess Anne. Like, that'd be terrifying. But he has, you know, he's happy to make a joke at her expense, and she knocks it right back. You know, they both hold their own when they're sort of mocking each other. You know, it's not a one-sided thing. Yeah, there was a great banter between the two of them.
Yeah, they just come across like, I'm always a sucker for family relationships, like that aren't your normal family relationships, that aren't like, you know, husband and wife or siblings, but like two young girls. I just love, even like in fiction or anything, I love weird family relationships that are nice. So I'm always a sucker for them. But yeah, I just think they just have such a healthy, happy relationship, and they're not afraid to share it with the world. And for Anne in particular, it just seems so against everything I think about Anne all of the time, so it just makes me laugh.
Yeah, I think my reasoning for picking William was very, I mean, I could, as I say, I could change it for Mike now, because I would be just as happy with that choice. But I think we don't normally see those two together, and so it's a, sort of an unseen banter we don't, you know, we don't normally get to be part of. But they, you know, they seem incredibly comfortable with each other. They obviously have this very long connection between the two of them. So they were able to make jokes about like things that they remembered from growing up, where, you know, when William was growing up and his sort of relationships with Zara and Peter. And, you know, they've got that kind of comfort level in jokes and things that come from knowing somebody your entire life. You know, we talked about this in episode 74 of like, they were actually surprisingly similar to each other. I would never normally think of them as I would think of them as being like polar opposites. She's sort of cynical and blunt, and William is sort of, he talks around things, and he's the champion of optimism at the moment. But they were saying like so many of the same things, and their response to why sports matters or why rugby matters, or, you know, all these sorts of things were so incredibly similar. They were maybe phrased in slightly different ways, but they were saying the exact same thing. So I was just like, gosh, you two are really like actually a lot more similar than the rest of us think. I also, I should just say, I feel really sorry for Kate. Because neither of us picked her in any of our configurations for this category. And I love Kate, but I think she was there laughing at the jokes rather than contributing to them.
Yeah. It's like, clearly there was a lot of sort of love between all of them.
Yes, for sure.
But Mike and Anne must have such a close relationship, and Anne and William have obviously known each other for 40 years. And there's a real sort of depth to that relationship that there wasn't between any of the others. And obviously William and Kate excluded, they have quite a deep relationship. But it was so nice to hear them talk about, you know, memories that they have as an aunt and a nephew rather than as two royals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it just came across, you could see how much they loved each other, and sort of there was the mutual respect they had for each other as well. Like, it wasn't just William being like, wow, that's my really cool Auntie Anne, or Anne being like, this is the future King William. They were just like, yeah, I have a lot of respect for this member of my family.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So I think, like, obviously there were the funny moments and things, but it was also just, I partly went for them just because I was like, I hadn't realized like that they are that close before. And I hadn't realized that they do actually see the world in surprisingly similar ways. It's just that they phrase it, or they go about it in a slightly different way, but they're starting off from the same point, or they want the same end goal. You know, like, I think we have this perception of them as being incredibly different people, but actually seeing them, you can kind of be like, oh no, these are both Windsors.
Yeah, they are full Windsors, 100%.
So our next category is the most heartwarming. And this was another one where I kind of wasn't really sure. I wasn't really sure for all of these, to be honest.
Yeah, there was no definite moment for me.
The only one I was definite on was Kate in the athletics. I didn't really go for like a moment as such. I should just say, because I'm making it sound way more exciting than it is. I went with the general behaviour of the Spanish royal family at Princess Leonor's 18th.
Oh, that's very sweet. I like that. I went with Princess Estelle in Victoria's dress at Carl Gustaf's 50th anniversary.
Oh, yeah. That's a lovely moment. And really, as somebody who runs a Victoria blog, I should pick her more often. But I think she could win every category all the time forever. I have to try and challenge myself to think of things that are not about Victoria. So that's my excuse.
Well, I think we've gone for very similar choices in what we've ended up with.
Yeah, in some ways, I think like the reasoning behind our choices will probably end up being very similar. So yes, we talked about this very recently, episode 79. I think there were lots of like really cute moments that happened that, you know, we talked about in that episode, but like Letizia and Felipe constantly fussing over Leonor's ponytail and whether it was in the right place. That was very funny, very sweet, very parental. There was Felipe almost bursting into tears every 5 seconds, which as this very like statuesque, confident, charismatic man was just very endearing. There was Leonor's like performance itself. I thought that was in a way heartwarming. My heart is warmed when I see a confident and intelligent young woman who is just entering into this really exciting phase of her life. She's just entering adulthood and she has so much promise ahead of her. And she seems to, you know, be so loved by so many people. I thought, you know, seeing her perform so well, having watched her grow up, was a very heartwarming thing for me. But the main thing, I think, was the relationship between her and her sister, Infanta Sofia. So I think this is something that comes out a lot of the events that they do, all the events that they do, but Infanta Sofia always looks so incredibly proud of Leonor at every possible opportunity. Every time Leonor gives a speech, Sofia's the first one to start clapping. She's always reaching out for a hug. She's got this look on her face of just as much pride as like Felipe and Letizia have. She is her sister's biggest cheerleader. And I think over the last few years, the news cycle around royals has been dominated by sibling rivalries and jealousy and resentment from lots of different royal families. And like this resentment around who gets to be the heir and who's the spare and that kind of whole thing. And to see somebody who is so young, like Sofia is still a child, have nothing but love and support for her sister, never seems to display any kind of jealousy or resentment. That to me is a really beautiful thing and a really encouraging thing to see. And I'm going to stop it because I'm getting soppy and that's not my comfort zone.
Yeah, I think, you know, Leonor and Sophia's relationship is one of my favorite royal relationships because they clearly have always absolutely adored each other.
Yeah.
I think for all of the Spanish media's attempts to paint, you know, Letizia as a domineering dragon mother, you know, she's done a fantastic job of raising two well-rounded girls who mm-hmm. are happy with each other and love spending time with each other and are proud of each other's accomplishments. Mm-hmm. Because it is hard sometimes to be proud of someone like your sister when they're doing something well. You're like, hang on, I've done good things.
Yeah.
What's my price?
Especially when you're a child still, you know.
And yeah, I think, honestly, the Spanish royal family have kind of gone really well for this heartwarming vibes this year because they are just winning all the soppy categories.
Best couple and the most heartwarming. Like, who would have thought? Okay, well, go for Estelle.
So I chose Estelle wearing her mother's dress because Estelle and Victoria's relationship is incredibly sweet. And Estelle is just like a little Victoria, but with elements of her dad in there. Estelle obviously went to her grandfather's anniversary and she didn't wear, you know, she did wear a princess dress, but she didn't wear, you know, a little princess dress. That was Estelle's special 11-year-old princess dress that she was going to wear for like her biggest event so far. She wore her mum's old dress. And, you know, from what we know of Victoria and Daniel and Estelle, I imagine, you know, there was a bit of a discussion and they were like, oh, what would you like to wear, Estelle? And I like to think she was like, I want to wear that dress that you're wearing, Mum? And they were like, oh God, we've got to get tailored now to fit 11 around. And I really like that dress, but we're going with it. I think we spoke about how much, you know, it managed to suit her with the kind of like taffeta and the ruffles at the time. But it really sort of suited her in a unique way than it suited Victoria. And it just kind of showed that they are two different people, but they sort of are the two sides of the same coin. But yeah, I just think it's very sweet.
It was very sweet. I think I'm such a sucker for royals wearing clothing from like previous generations. I think just hand-me-downs, really. I'm not that excited about them when it's... No, that's not true. I am excited. I like tradition. Not in the sort of, you know, far right, what they think of as being tradition. I just mean like harmless things that like you've done in your family for generations and generations that are just for you. They don't really impact anybody else. And the Swedish royal family do that quite a lot. You know, the Brits get a lot of attention for like whenever they've dressed George or Louis or whoever in clothes that William wore when he was younger and things like that. But the Swedish royal family do it an awful lot. But I think it's much more common with like babies and toddlers or when they're grown-ups and they wear sort of the same, you know, they're both wearing adult clothing, to actually have gone to the extra effort of like taking something that Victoria wore and making it like miniature. It's quite rare. So it was very sweet.
We both very much went for like the young royals and their sort of family relationships. And I think overall that has been like some of the sweetest moments of the year has been seeing the young royals interacting with each other or with their sort of family. Our next category is the biggest plot twist. And I genuinely do not remember what we chose last year as a plot twist.
Do you not?
Was it the us killing the queen?
It was the queen. Yeah, the queen died. I was going to say like, oh, well, last year was so easy because we had an obvious one. The queen died. Killed her. I thought you were being sarcastic for a minute. Because I was like, of course we chose the queen dying.
I genuinely did not remember what we chose it for. I didn't pick anything quite that dramatic this year. I went for Rajwa and Hussein's wedding.
Interesting. Okay.
What did you choose?
So I chose the Thai succession crisis.
Oh, okay. Very different choices.
Very different choices, yes. I was going to be snarky and say Kate Middleton doing an engagement around textiles. So 4 years, if you don't know this inside joke, 4 years ago, Kate went and did something, and on the social media of Kensington Palace, they said that over the coming months, were their words, Kate would be doing some engagements around textiles and exploring her interest in textiles. And then she didn't do a single thing about textiles for over 4 years. And every single year I would post like a rest in peace on the anniversary of that engagement where they said she was going to explore her interest in textiles. And then finally this year she did something about textiles. I was going to choose that and be really snarky, but then I went with something serious.
But that was a great plot twist moment, not going to lie.
Yeah,
it shocked everyone to our core.
It really did. Okay, right. Go for... I'm not going to be able to say too much on Hussein and Rajwa, but go for it.
I chose Rajwa and Hussein's wedding because it was so enjoyable. In a weird way, everything that happened on the day was a bit of an odd thing that I wasn't expecting, from Rajwa's dress choices to seeing sort of Hussein being so emotional, to Kate and William turning up. Yeah, I think... the entire day, I was not expecting to be remotely that interested in. I went to town and then I went to the cinema. So I was in town. It was very inconvenient getting all these notifications on my phone. I was like, no, this is so exciting. And I was watching it like on my phone on 3G, like on a Jordanian live stream, which is really hard to do on a bus.
I can imagine.
but I really enjoyed, in a very sickening way, how many people were sort of involved and everyone was talking about it and be like, oh my God, look, he's here, look at this outfit. And it was a very sweet day. I really enjoyed it and I just was not expecting to in any way. And I think throughout the day, there was just so many moments. I was like, didn't see that coming. Wasn't expecting that. Didn't see that coming. So it was just a day of plot twists for me. And the biggest plot twist was how much I loved it.
Well, I mean, their engagement was a plot twist. Nobody even knew they were dating, and suddenly he was engaged to this woman we knew nothing about. So they've just... Yes. They're the couple of plot twists, apparently.
Yeah, I think there were quite a few things I could have chosen for plot twists, because on like a minor level, like there were lots of small twists, but this was the one that I was not expecting to remotely care about Raja and Hossein's wedding beyond seeing what dress she was wearing. And it, I think, might have been one of my favourite moments of the year. And I just loved it. And I loved everyone being there and engaged and talking about it. So yeah, plot twisted me because it was fun.
Well, I can't say too much. So I'll just talk about mine then. So mine was the Thai succession crisis, which happened actually sort of December, January time. So we were doing this November to November. So even though it's not all in this calendar year, it is in the year of the award ceremony. and so the king of Thailand's daughter, Princess Bajrakisiyapa, collapsed suddenly at the age of 44. She had been incredibly healthy. She'd done like military service. She was out training her dogs at the time. So she's obviously somebody who goes, you know, even if it's just going for walks or runs, is an active person. And there was no indication that she was unwell whatsoever. It was just, she just dropped suddenly and was taken to hospital. And Thai sources are very vague, and there's a lot of rules around what you're allowed to say and what you aren't in the press. So a lot of this information has come from foreign journalists, but it's believed that she is medically dead. And I mean, I think regardless of whether it's royal or not, somebody who is very healthy and quite young, collapsing and essentially being gone in the blink of an eye is a shocking thing to happen. They haven't given us any update for quite a while on her status, but it's not believed that anything has changed. So she's effectively probably dead. I bet now next week you'll be like, and she's fine. And I'll be totally wrong about this. But that's what it's believed to be anyway. She's very seriously ill. And her death opened up a massive crisis, because you can go back and listen to the episode about it, but essentially, there are no other valid candidates to take on the role of monarch. So the king has a son, but he's believed to have autism, and it presents in such a way that he wouldn't be able to reign on his own. His other daughter's, you know, unacceptable. Everybody in the royal family has had daughters or has been, you know, excluded for various reasons. And so there literally was nobody who could realistically take over after Bajrakisiyapa. And this is, again, a very rare thing. So it threw the whole thing into crisis. And to the extent that in recent months, and we talked about this in episode 71, in recent months, the king has brought back his sons. Well, we don't know that he's brought them back, but he has been involved in them coming back. His sons, who were previously exiled, like, that's pretty significant. They had their titles removed, placed in the line of succession removed. They were exiled and living in the USA. And two of them have come back to Thailand to visit, to do what was a pseudo-royal tour, really, and start that rehabilitation process to kind of give them a couple more candidates. So I think it was a plot twist for me in lots of different levels, because I hadn't expected Bajrakisiyapa to, you know, die or become very, very ill. That was not something that was on my radar at all this year. So that's one thing. The second thing was like the fact that it opened up this massive crisis in Thailand, which we all should have seen coming, but didn't really. And then lastly, the fact that sons that he exiled a very long time ago when they were children are being brought back into the fold as if nothing has ever happened. You know, it's a bit of a niche one because not everyone pays attention to the Thai royal family, but it fascinates me. And it was a really big shock for me.
Yeah, I think the king's sons coming back in particular was a shock, because I think I would have, we discussed it and we were like, that would be the logical thing to do, except they've been raised out of their country. And as far as we know, they've had no contact with their father. And we had this whole discussion about whether or not we thought it would happen. Even, you know, when, you know, the king's son, his eldest son was back in Thailand and he did this sort of mini royal tour of Thailand and, you know, met with senior religious figures and one of the royal sort of nurseries. And it was like, he didn't just go to Thailand and, you know, on a holiday and meet his dad. He did royal engagements, and it was, the whole thing was a bit bizarre. And like you said, if you asked us 12 months ago, I would have solidly said no chance that would be happening within a year. So yeah, I definitely see what you're coming from with that. I like that as a plot twist. It was a plot twist. I agree.
Yeah. I wish they'd stop making 700 Diana TV shows, because we already know that story, and start focusing on the really dramatic stuff. Do a TV show that is set during the Thai succession crisis. I would lap that up. It would be so good.
It would be cracking. It would be so dramatic. They could kill so many people in the background. It'd be amazing. I think we should pitch that to Hollywood. They could do a great job.
If somebody could give me the number of Hollywood, I would definitely pitch it. Our superstar is the next category. So essentially the royal who's done the best job or who stood out the most to us over the course of the year or whatever. I mean, a random comment that I think applies to this category and the next one is, it's been a really middling year.
Yes.
That's my observation. These are the two big categories we're getting into now. The last two are the big ones. And I really struggled with both of them. I actually came up with this at like 1 a.m.
I like that. I like your last minute. Not quite as last minute as me last year, but I do like your last minute choices.
Yeah. Yeah. At least I thought of this one before I actually opened my mouth, you know? Yes. So I have gone with Prince Daniel.
Now, I've got a little story about who I am. Okay. Because I obviously had an absolute disaster with this last year. So pretty much as soon as the episode ended, I got on my phone and I wrote Superstar Royal and have been ranking royals throughout the year. So I've been ranking them on things like whether I've enjoyed the engagements they've done, whether they've made me laugh, whether they've done something that's like a standout for me. And there have been royals that have floated to the top and then disappeared. And for, I'm going to say, almost the entire year, I had two royals battling for top two positions. And one of those royals who did not make it, sadly, was King Charles. It's got to be his year. He was at the top for a very long time and he's just dipped to number two. He's been sort of rotating with this other person. And I very nearly went for him because obviously he got crowned. It's been a big year for him. He's done a lot of important things. However, and this will surprise everyone, my top royal of the year is Prince William. Actually, is in this time. He's been at the top for so long. I was like, I've got to pick him. It's got to be really
so much effort in, and you came out with the same result as when you literally thought about it for 3 seconds last year.
I know. I was like, oh god, it actually is going to be Prince William. About halfway through the year, I was like, it's going to be him again, isn't it?
Like, okay, right. Well, you've got to break down the solid bank of data that you've got that, you know, justify.
Okay, so right at the start of the year, William did a lot of UK-based engagements that I really enjoyed, and I don't watch William engagements, so it was a lot of like things with families or young children, things with meeting people in like from different walks of life, meeting people who perhaps are in poverty. So that started him off fairly high because I was just enjoying his normal day-to-day engagements. Then he did a few like video speechy things that I enjoyed and they made me laugh. And then at Charles's coronation, he gave this speech and it's not that good a speech, honestly, I've watched it back. But it was during the the coronation concert, and he gave a speech and it just came across like a king's speech. Like, it was really good. I am actually doing speeches in school with the kids, and that was one of the speeches we watched, and they loved it. They thought it was hilarious. I was like, it was not that funny, guys. But they were like, he's very funny as Prince William. I was like, okay, I'm writing that down for later. But he made his family laugh in the speech, but it came across like a real statesman speech. I thought seeing him and Hussein at Rajwan Hussein's wedding was incredibly lovely and sweet. Watching him interact with different members of his family, like with Mike and Anne in the podcast, I adored. He had his trip to the Ukrainian border with Poland when Russia, which was like one of those high level visits that they always seem to give to William. I actually quite enjoyed his trip to Singapore, the parts of it I watched. And I really like, even though it annoys me, his optimistic approach to things.
Yeah.
Because I think something he said, and it was the end of last year, so just after last year's Earthshot, something about how everything, when we try and like change the world, is really like negative. And people are like, it's a disaster. We're all going to die by the year 2050 because we'll be flooded to death. And he was like, why not be positive when there are actually some good things happening? And sometimes I think he might take that a bit too far because he only ever focuses on positive. It's like, we're going to end homelessness. Isn't that great? But I think I really like his approach to things, and we end up in a situation where actually, you know, I have gained in the last year a lot of respect for William, particularly because I think a lot of people take made up issues they have with, you know, because of this sort of family drama, or he tends to be the scapegoat above anyone else. I think he's made mistakes. I don't think he's some sort of flawless person. Even this year, he's made mistakes and done things that have annoyed me. And occasionally I'm like, right, that's it. You're dropping down to 10th on my list. And I'm like, he crawls his way back up again. And he's not my favourite royal. Like, he doesn't make my top five royals. However, this year, he has been the royal that stood out to me the most.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fair enough then. I talked last week about how some things that William says worry me. If I just look at what he does on a day-to-day basis and the work that he does do his job very, very well. Recently, there was an example where he went to Manchester, and he went to this charity that basically he'd met the woman who runs it before a garden party and had promised her at the garden party that he was going to go and visit her charity. And he did. And he's done that consistently, where he could get himself in trouble by like, yeah, I'll come and visit. Yeah, I'll come and say hello. Oh, yeah, I'll speak to you on the phone. Yeah, I'll do this, to promising everyone everything. But he always does it.
Yeah, that's my favourite thing about William. And actually, after his Singapore visit, he annoyed me just enough that he dropped to second place. And then that's why he went back up, was his little return to Manchester. Because he does it so consistently. And there's been this real thing on social media recently, like William makes all these vowels and doesn't follow them through. But most of the vowels are what the newspapers make. And they're like, William vows to end drama in the Middle East. And it's like, William's never said that. He just said, I hope there will be peace in my lifetime. You know, like a normal statesman's speech. The only two things he's ever vowed to end are climate change and homelessness, which, I mean, I'm not sure he's ever going to manage, but, you know, fair play to him if he does. But these little promises he makes to individual people, like, I will come and visit you. The one he made when he went to meet the Grenfell survivors with the Queen, and they asked them not to go, and he went, I'll promise I will be back. And he went back quite a few times with Kay, or by himself, or with Harry. It's one of these things, but if I was out, you know, in public and William went past and I was like, come, you have to come visit this thing that's really important to me, I think he would come. Whereas I don't necessarily think many other royals would go like, oh, can you find that girl and see what she was going on about? Miss would be like, yeah, I'll be there. But he would go. And I have a lot of confidence he would be there.
One of the most important things about monarchy is sort of this stability and dependability. And I think having somebody who doesn't sound like much, but having somebody who follows through on their promises and remembers people and remembers what they promised, these things, that's quite a significant thing. Like, it does make him seem like somebody who you can rely on to keep to his word, which is something that you really want in a monarch. So yeah, I think it's fair enough choice.
Yeah, it was a shock to me, and I was very much fighting it for several months. But yeah, no, we're gonna have to give him another crown, honestly.
Too many, can I say. So yeah, so I went with Prince Daniel. So I think he has had a really good year, generally speaking. So, for example, at the moment, we're right in the middle of this, but he will visit 4 countries in 6 weeks, which is pretty impressive. Not for holidays,
very impressive.
For work.
Yes. Trips around the world.
Yeah. This year was also his 50th birthday, and there was a documentary on him where I think he came across incredibly well. He was very funny, like had lots of dry quips that he was, you know, very quick-witted. He came across as really informed about the things that he cares about. He could speak about them really confidently. And, you know, he just, in general, came across as a really nice guy. I think it was a really strong documentary. But I think my rationale for this is, I think sometimes we focus on like the splashy royals and the big achievements, and we forget about those royals who are often in the background. Often those royals are the people who are actually the backbone of the royal family. And I think Daniel is one of those category. And this year he got a bit of a moment for himself to kind of shine, you know, because it was his 50th. Because also his birthday is the day that the king took the throne. So every time the king has a jubilee, it's also like a big birthday for Daniel, but he never gets to do anything. So he's literally over, you know, outshone at every opportunity. But this was his like moment to shine. Some of the things that came out, you know, he was asked in this documentary about like what it's like to, as a man, to kind of always have to walk 2 steps behind his wife. And his answer was really great about like, I know my place, I know what my job is, I know what I'm here to do. And Victoria's, people love Victoria and they always want to talk to her. And I think that's a beautiful thing. So I'm happy to kind of let that happen and be there and do what I can do, but I know it's not about me.
I definitely see what you're saying, because I would never have thought of Daniel, I don't think, in a million years. He was not on my radar at all this year. However, I fully agree with everything you said, and like, this is his, in a weird way, it's his year to shine because it's his big 50th. But also, everything he's done this year is what he's been doing for the last 10 plus years. And it just happens to be this year he also gets a little bit for him. And, you know, we talk a lot about how she is like the epitome of an heir. But how much of that is her natural sort of abilities and charm, and how much of it is because she knows she has this really secure backup system at home.
Yeah, I think behind every royal, there's like a million people who, you know, from the staff to their spouses or, you know, their children or whoever, there's a million other people who make them who they are and make them able to do that job. And I think Daniel is that for Victoria. And it was just, you know, it's not a new fact. It's not a new groundbreaking thing that happened that we only found out about this year. But I think having this documentary and getting to really hear from him about his thoughts on the situation and his thoughts on his job and what he does, it just sort of solidified for me that, you know, when he's given the opportunity to kind of speak his mind, he makes it about other people, and he makes sure to give Victoria her credit and not sort of woe is me, I have to walk behind my wife sort of thing. You know, it exemplified to me why he is such a good royal, because he does huge amounts of work, and there's been a lot of big achievements. You know, he has loads of things named after himself and loads of his own charitable initiatives, and he does a lot of work throughout the course of the year, and he doesn't really get a significant amount of praise for it. So like, to me this year, nobody really stood out as being like an amazing, having the, like, an amazing year. But when I looked back on it, I was like, you know what, actually, Daniel had a year where we all got to kind of quietly go, oh yeah, actually, you've been doing a good job and nobody's been saying it. And it was, I thought that was nice.
Yeah, I like that. I think he's a really good choice. So our final category, the best film Oscar of them all, the top moment of the year, was really hard to pick.
Yes, yeah, it was really hard, yeah.
Because again, it's been a very middling year. And I've cheated and picked two, but they are very similar and kind of linked, so I get away with it.
All right, okay, I'll give it to you.
My more of a thing moment that I went for was the Wells family volunteering with the scouts just after the coronation. But my top moment of the year, which is literally just a moment, was when Kate walked out at the coronation and I solidly blacked out for 10 minutes. And I don't know what happened.
Well, we already know mine.
Figure it out.
Yeah. Mine was a surprise to me because I actually don't really like this royal family very much at all. And that was the wedding of Crown Prince Hussein of Jordan and Rajwa, his wife, Princess Rajwa.
Yeah. So if I start with my actual favourite moment of the year, Kate in that cape and the headdress, I think in the build-up to the coronation, I was about to lose my mind if I heard anyone else talking about tiaras or what Kate was going to wear and whether or not she was going to wear a suit. But it became such a big thing and it was driving me mad. And then she came out of the car in a white Alexander McQueen dress. Like, that was obvious, guys, come on. And she was wearing the cape from her honours, which she's never worn before because she doesn't do anything with them. She wears the little mini badges instead of the full, it's probably not called a cape really, it's got an actual name, but I'm going to call it a cape. And she was wearing her floral headpiece, and Charlotte had a matching one in miniature, and Lulu was so glitzy and glamorous, and then people started being like, it's not really a tiara, and I was like, yeah, it's better than a tiara because it looks great. I was just absolutely blown away, and I genuinely did black out from the moment she got out of the car until probably like the first 5 minutes of the coronation had already gone through. I was like, oh my god, what's going on? I don't remember what happened in that period of time. I was texting you, I stopped texting everyone for 10 minutes because I blacked out. But because it was literally just seeing some guy out of a car, I chose another route, which was the Wells family volunteering, because it was the only group from the royal families that wasn't announced in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I was getting really annoyed with people being like, oh, they're not going to volunteer because they want to be with the children. I was like, they're clearly going to do something. Essentially, all of my top moments are when I get annoyed with people for saying something that doesn't end up happening.
Yeah.
But then we saw the Wells family out, and they were all getting involved from, you know, Charlotte painting, to them putting their handprints on the walls, and George using like a drill to build things, and Louis digging things, and you know, seeing William and Louis and George in the sort of JCB digger. And you know, William made me laugh quite a bit on that day. That was a solid humor moment for him. And just watching them sort of interact with each other and hearing them chatting as a family, which we never get to do because they're always on duty and standing sensibly and shaking hands. And I think, you know, the year before we had the Jubilee concert where we got to see all the children interacting. And in years gone by, we've had the polo matches where we've seen all the children interacting. And they've become less and less over the last few years. So getting to see them all just being happy as a family and eating s'mores and throwing themselves into things was just really nice and unexpected. And I'm just really glad it happened.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very sweet moment. You know, you're right. Like when you compare it, like last year there were so many moments because of the Jubilee, that we got to see like Louis being adorable on the balcony and all these sorts of things. And it does feel like there's been less of that this year. It's been less of like a child. I feel we've barely seen Louis. Where's Louis been?
Yeah, let's have a look. Come on, guys.
Feel like I haven't seen him in ages. I'm trying to remember specific moments. Did somebody like almost knock over a digger or?
William and Louis were in there with the digger, and like Louis was like, "I'm gonna have fun," and William was like,
Try
"No."
not to kill the heir to the throne. And they did one of their glossy videos afterwards as well, I remember.
Yeah, they did. It was a very good video.
Yeah. And also, like, I don't think you need to be ashamed of the fact that your first moment was the 10-minute blackout that you had. Like, she did, I mean, the photographs from that day. Like, one of the reasons I couldn't be a royal, I think, is because I'd be worried about, I'm not a photogenic person, and I'd worry that all the photographs of me would be hideous, and I'd like be sitting looking at newspapers like, oh my God, why did I do that? Why did I pose like that? I can't go outside again. But like, if that was me, I'd be like, wow, I never need to pose for another photograph again because I looked incredible.
You'll be like, that's it now.
Yeah,
Like
I'm
peak
done.
moment. Can't top that one.
No, it was so like, oh, like a moment, like she looked powerful.
Yeah. She looked like a queen. And I was like, wow. And then I blacked
Well, yeah, I mean, mine is probably a bit of an anticlimax now because we've already talked about it a little bit. But the wedding of Crown Prince Hussein and Princess Rajwa, as I say, it surprised me because I like Hussein. Rajwa, I know nothing about her whatsoever. But their wedding, actually, episode 65, did you know, Grace? Well, you didn't know this because I haven't told you before. It's actually our second most popular episode ever.
Did not know that, and I would not have guessed that either.
No. But surprising. After our first top episode is our first episode, obviously. And then the second one is that one. Fun fact. But anyway,
Wow.
yeah. I picked it for a few different reasons, and thankfully some of them are things that you haven't mentioned, so that's good. I'm not just repeating you. So the first one was it was actually just like really fun to watch because I'm used to live streams where it's like Hugh Edwards, it won't be him anymore, but he had a big scandal, if you don't know. But Hugh Edwards usually is in a studio somewhere, or somebody else like is in a studio somewhere, and they're interviewing people like Alan Titchmarsh, who's a gardener, or they're interviewing
Tom Cruise, for
Tom
some
Cruise
reason.
for some reason. It's always boring people talking about boring things, and they have to try and make it interesting. Whereas in the Jordanian live stream that I was watching, they had a DJ and they had just a dance break halfway through. It was so fun. I had no idea what was going on at all because there was no like translation. Obviously, don't speak Arabic. It was so fun. The second thing was, I think it was really enjoyable for me to watch a wedding that was from such a different culture and a different religion. You know, I have seen a lot of Church of England weddings in my time, and I'm allowed to say this because I grew up Anglican. They're quite boring. I've never been to a Muslim wedding before. I've never actually seen one, I don't think, other than maybe like in a soap opera, you know, or something like that. And you know, I thankfully have a couple of Arab Muslim friends who know about a lot of the traditions and where they come from. They were able to explain it as things were going on and answer questions. And you know, it was a really lovely opportunity to learn. Like weddings are not normally an opportunity for me to learn about anything. And then yeah, I guess the last thing that I had in my list of reasons why I picked it was just like it kind of relates to the second point about like just learning about something different. Of like it really felt joyful, like. It felt the music, the fact that when they were doing their drive through the streets of Jordan, there were no cordons up. and people were just like running into the road, and like the dancing, it was kind of like a tourist video for Jordan. It was like just a pure expression of Jordanian culture, and it just felt so much fun. And like, you know, this really long event with loads of music and sounds and colors and dancing and fireworks, and like just seemed like, so it would have been so much fun to be at.
Yeah, I think both of our top moments last year were top moments because they were moments when like everyone was sort of back on Tumblr. And I felt really similar with this wedding, because I think 5-10 years ago, like, there was such a community of royal watching, and then like a few years ago it shattered and it's never come back. And there's just these odd moments like the coronation and this wedding and our two top moments from last year, so Ingrid's birthday and the Jubilee, where suddenly these people who hadn't been here for years were like, oh, I've come back for this, because it's important and it's exciting and we're seeing all these different people. And I think for Raja and Hussein's wedding, what you said about it being joyful was that's what it was at its heart. It was a happy day, mm-hmm. and everyone was happy and celebrating, and you could just see people, you know, it didn't matter who your favorite royals were because they were there, and everyone was like, oh my god,
yeah,
like, this is exciting and it's fun.
Because like having this event where all eyes from all, as you say, you know, if you were a Beatrice fan, Beatrice was there. If you're a Kate fan, Kate was there. If you're a Dutch or Danish or a Swedish royal family fan, there was somebody there for you. And so we were all sort of watching the same thing. And I know from friends of mine how special it felt to them to see like their culture being praised and being looked at so positively, and having so many people watching a cultural display that they recognized, and, you know, the traditions that they have in their own family. And, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, royal watching is so Western.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact, you know, there are more monarchies in, you know, the East, in like Asia or Africa, than there are in the West. And it's really rare that there is a sort of an event with an Asian royal family or an African royal family that is like people just get into and watch without. And also, I think because it was a wedding and because it was Hussein and Rajwa, who, you know, we don't know that much about them as individuals, and what we know about Hussein is fairly positive. Often when there is something happening in an Eastern country, even if it's a happy thing, people are like, oh, but, you know, human rights, guys.
Yes, yeah.
It's like, well, far as I know, Hussein's not committed any human rights violations. And it's not like Britain hasn't had human rights violations in the past. So, or even right now, it's so easy for these days that I think particularly for people from, you know, Arab Muslims who want to see their culture celebrated, there must be this kind of fear that, oh, on that day, you're going to have to deal with people being like, yeah, but it's horrible to live there. And there was, you know, very, very little of that, which was really nice to see.
And, you know, there was like fire and stuff. And I will always choose an event with fire if I can. This is the secret, guys. If you want to, if you're a royal family representative listening right now and you're desperate to be named as our top moment of the year, set something on fire.
We'll be there. It's like, yeah, top moment.
Yep.
See those flames?
Yeah. So, yeah, that was mine. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for the second annual On Air Podcast Awards Ceremony Prize Giving Event. That's the full title. we'll try and shorten that down to a snappy acronym. Yeah, thank you for joining us. Please do let us know who you would have picked for these categories. And if you'd like us to add categories for next time, if we're still here in a year, then please do send them across on our Tumblr or our Instagram, or by email if you want to. We'll put all of the contact details in the description. Otherwise, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.